So hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming over today. This presentation is in English. Any English speakers in here, English only ones? Yeah, very good. So that made sense. Perfect. I let it sink in like these wonderful images for you for a moment. So why do I do this presentation? So I've been in software engineering like since the late 90s. I started very early. So I do professional commercial software development as well as some open source projects. So and I would say roughly like 3 to 4 years ago, I got fascinated by building like really old software, like new old software, because there's a vintage computing community that slowly grew over the last few years that gets involved into keeping old computers alive, right? Which is absolutely fantastic. I have an iMac G3 from 98 at home and a couple of devices that you'll see in this presentation, and it's a lot of fun to build for them. So that's one aspect why I do the presentation. The second aspect is, over the years, if you look back into where software development evolved, and I'm only doing 30 years, my father said, why are you not doing 40 years? You're missing out what I did back then. So, but 40 years, that would be a conference all in itself, I think. So I'm doing the last 30 years. And one thing is that you'll see if you do vintage if you do programming for like really old computers just for fun or because you do migrations, is you'll see a lot of things that repeat themselves, like mistakes that were done like 20 years ago or done 10 years ago again and over and over and over. So hopefully this gives you, like, what I want to achieve with this presentation is to give you an insight on how fun it is to build like very old software. That's one thing. Second thing is, to give you an impression where your software might end up. Yeah, so if you look at 2030, which is around the corner, yeah, your software could be exactly like this Visual Basic application. And also to kind of take some learnings of what happened to the software world in the last 30 years. So the way I'm going to approach this presentation is that we'll go through the different eras of software development and look through what it was like. Right. So, and we're starting off with an absolute classic from 91, could also be 90, but 91, that was Visual Basic 2.0. Anyone in this room use Visual Basic 2.0? Fantastic. So you know the pain. The retail price back then was $89. That's roughly adjusted to inflation, $174, 167 euros. So the way it came was in a package. I think you probably had the boxed version then. You could order it in the box. I had the boxed version. You got it shipped. Of course, there was no Stack Overflow back then, so you probably also had yourself a Visual Basic book that kind of went through all the details of how to program Visual Basic. And then your wonderful Visual Basic IDE and many comparables like Object Pascal, Delphi later, were pretty much all the same. Yes, they had syntax highlighting, but not the way you're like used to it in modern day Eclipse or Visual Studio Code or whatever you prefer. Totally different animal. Your screen was also pretty small, right? So you were looking at the small CRT screen. You were hacking your software only with your book because and a couple of books you had, there was no internet forums that would like give you guidelines. A couple of things back then didn't exist, like clean coding styles, etc. You can look them up online, but you couldn't back then. And then once you had it all done, you would probably ship your software on a floppy disk. Or if you were super like modern, you would ship it on a CD, but most of your customers didn't have CDs. So you shipped it on like 3, 4, 5 floppies, depending on the size of your software. And what you wanted was that you wanted it to fit on a single floppy. Yeah, and you had to make sure that it kind of supported all versions of Windows 3 if you were building for Windows 3. So that was kind of very different. And patches and updates, you also had to deliver on floppy disks. So if you were like living in Bonn and you wanted that piece of software, it had to come all over the world if it was like built in San Francisco or the other way around. So that was very messy and complicated. And it was an era where software was mostly your desktop applications, your executable, and coupled with maybe a small like flat file database like DBase or Microsoft Access. That was how stuff worked back in the days. So 90% of the application, I'm not talking about the large scale ones, we're not going to go into large scale enterprise, more like into the fun stuff that most of you kind of know. But on a small business level, business applications or home applications meant it was a small executable file on a floppy disk. You inserted it, it had a small database, and then you did your thing, right? And you did backups. I mean, probably two or three people did backups. The rest just said, oh my God, I lost my data. So that was the Visual Basic era. That was also, if you look at history, a time where software development really got traction in terms of how many developers there were, how many people got involved in software development. So that was really, the early 90s were a turning point. And I'm going to go a few years forward now to 96, because that kind of mantra of building desktop applications with a small database, both on the Mac as well as on Windows, which were the dominant systems back then for small businesses and home users, that was pretty much how things were. Right, and you got your updates on floppy disks. Then the internet came. Maybe you already downloaded updates and things like that. But that was pretty slow. And then web development in its first steps, it started in the early 1990s. But if you look at the adoption curve of the internet, like back in the 90s, 95, 96 is really were the years when it kind of grew, where it really took traction. But it was very, very basic. Very basic. So you were just doing HTML, a couple of tables. It was all table layouts back then. You probably had something like Front Page or your text editor. Dreamweaver was very, very popular back then. And then you were just building like your HTML pages, some nice animated GIFs, and you were just dropping it onto your web server somewhere. And that was pretty much web development back then. There was nothing where you would like write big applications. If you were to write like e-commerce application, like Amazon in its first years, that was mainly a common gateway interface on your web server where you would write a real application on the operating system and it would process any incoming HTTP requests, render the HTML server site, and then just return the result because you had no session management, you had no cookies. JavaScript was more or less just for some fancy functionality. There was really nothing useful you could do with JavaScript back then. And that was kind of the early days of web development. And it was, some people often refer to it as the plugin hell, because you had real player for audio video streaming, and it was not comparable to your today streaming experience. You had things like the very popular Shockwave, then back Flash Player today, luckily it's gone. And that was kind of how things were. Yeah? So if you were writing a real complex application where people could like interact with your website, that was all server-side. So the modern fuzz about server-side rendering, that already existed like back in the 90s. And then building mobile apps. Yeah, everybody knows what a mobile app is, like iOS and Android, and building fancy mobile apps. Well, the way you build fancy mobile apps in 97 was on the most popular platform, which was Palm OS, was the most popular mobile platform. And your target platform had a 60 megahertz Motorola processor, 2 megabytes. The size restriction, I think, for your executable application was something around 50 kilobytes. So, and if you would exceed your RAM above 200 kilobytes, it would kill your application because you were just eating up way too much memory. So, of course, because the devices were so small, I don't know, has any one of you ever used a Palm? Yeah, very nice. So the image on the bottom here, that's mine. So I have an entire article that's linked on the conference site, where I have a video about how to connect it to Wi-Fi and get it online in 2022. So, and that was what you were mainly building. Yeah? So you were sitting in front of your Visual Studio C++ or others. There was a limited set of IDEs their SDK supported. And then you were writing your Palm OS application. And if you look at how the rendering works and how the application is structured, it's very, very similar to what you see in Android and iOS. And if you look at the way the user interface is designed and how people would operate it, you would see that it's very, very similar. So this, the Palm pretty much, and building for the Palm is pretty much the grandfather of mobile app development. If you're into mobile app development, I highly recommend take a look at the early days of it. You know, it's very exciting and frustrating, and debugging is a different animal on the small devices, because they just don't have the performance to do so. Yeah? TCP IP support is very, very interesting. It's, I think, doing a simple HTTP request, unencrypted, of course, this thing is way too lightweight to do encryption, is, I think, only 2,000 to 3,000 lines of code for a single HTTP request. That's super easy, but you can crash the application. And of course, when this thing does network connections, the entire device freezes because it like, needs the entire device to do it. Yeah. So that's totally different back then. Because it's 97, most of the applications for Palm were deployed over the internet. So people downloaded them, they bought them online, they sent their credit card details unencrypted to some server to download the application, and then it was charged. So that was the way it worked. They also had something, I think, in late 99, which they called, I don't remember, it was like web HTML packaged in a form that you could use it as some sort of application on the device. So building mobile apps with HTML in 98, yeah, that was a thing. And a popular one, to be honest, a very popular one, because the devices rarely had live internet access. You could pair them with your mobile phone and infrared, but most people would sync them in the morning, so they would synchronize all the contents and update the kind of mobile apps that they wanted to be fresh, and then they would go on with their day. So that was kind of mobile app development that there, but I also have a slide with something fancy about mobile web coming later on. So then macOS, for those of you who are familiar with the Mac, is macOS from the very first Macintoshes on was pretty much the same operating system until macOS version 9. Yeah, when Apple decided to like dump the entire base of their operating system and replace it with the BSD-style OS X, which they still operate today as macOS. And writing code for Mac up until version 9 for the classic macOS, yeah, that's a totally different developer experience. I mean, if you think the developer experience on Windows 3 and Windows 95 was bad, you haven't seen the Mac. Yeah? Apart with the monthly Mac developer update CDs that you better read the contents on, because otherwise strange things happen. And downwards compatibility on the Mac wasn't as good as on Windows. So, but there were tons of languages for the Mac. Visual Basic, very popular one back then. Pascal, C++ was the standard for the machine, although kind of the base system was Objective-C and their ancestors. Pretty comparable to Windows 3, I would say. Pretty comparable to Windows 3, Windows 95 development. Same thing, the early deployments on floppy disk, later deployments on CD, sometimes deployment through the web if people already had a modem. But imagine if you like have an application that is maybe 50 megabytes large, that takes an extreme amount of time to download with your 56K modem. So people wouldn't do that. Yeah? And I think that was kind of some of the last examples of that kind of software development. It's very hard to tell you what it feels like if you go into an IDE like CodeWarrior, the last version of CodeWarrior for macOS 9 or the early Visual Studios. What I recommend is get yourself a virtual machine, try it yourself. And trust me, it's not very comfortable. It's not very comfortable. But I definitely recommend trying it, because if you hate your development environment today, you definitely want to try the older ones. And trust me, you'll fall in love all over again. It's a totally different thing. And I think one of the most common things that you realize is autocomplete things like Microsoft's IntelliSense, that you have like autocomplete for classes and things like that. That was not a thing back then. Yeah? And then Googling things that you don't know or error codes, that was not a thing. I remember I once built an application that used cryptography to encrypt some data and used RSA. That was around 20 years ago. And Windows 98 kept throwing error messages with the content, an error occurred, no error message exists. And it took me a week to figure out that just the byte size I passed into the system library on Windows 98 was smaller than on any other Windows version, including NT4. And that would just result in some error. Well, you could look it up today, right, and figure it out and kind of see what the requirements are. Back then, that was like really tough to do. And then we come to web development, like second stage. The early web development we've seen was pretty much just doing HTML pages. And if you wanted to do some server-side stuff, you probably did it as a CGI application. Most popular in Perl, In C++ and many other languages, where you just had a binary sitting behind your Apache or whatever web server you used back then, that was would just be invoked by the web server and then called. And that was very complicated. Not a lot of people could do that. So that's why there were a couple of inventions like PHP, which is still alive, ASP, which is still alive as some sort of part of Microsoft, .NET. We have Java server pages. And yeah, that came around 2000. So 1999, 2000, it became a thing where you could, in the Microsoft world, use Visual Basic Script or JavaScript to write server-side applications. So that was the second appearance of JavaScript as a server-side language, because the not very popular Netscape communication server that Netscape released, because Netscape invented JavaScript, was the first appearance of JavaScript on the server side. This is the second one brought up by Microsoft. However, Visual Basic Script was most of the cases more popular. Yeah? And client-side JavaScript started as well. Yeah? In the bottom left, you can see some code of a server-side Visual Basic application doing a database connection. So the way it worked was that you could mix up HTML code with your server-side code, and then the once the web server realized, okay, I have these tags in there, or I have this file extension, it would pass the file on to an interpreter, which would do the action, and that's it. Pretty much pretty boring, because you know how it works with PHP and many of these others. But it was still what we today call three-tier web applications. So you have the client software, HTML and JavaScript and CSS when it arrived. You have your web server backend application, the application that runs on the server, and you have your database. Yeah? And keep the three-tier web app principle in mind, because we'll come back to it later. And then you might have some aha moments, because that's kind of the old stuff. Most of the people here that were born before 2000, and keep in mind the people that were born in 2000 already have their driving license, this is kind of repetition, right? So Dreamweaver, again, was very popular. Eclipse and all those kind of IDEs came up. That was around 2000. And then we have one of my favorites. Hands up who has used the WAP. Yeah, awesome. Yeah. If you ask that in a kind of different audience, people will look like, what? So isn't that the thing that if you accidentally push the internet button, like you'll have an extremely high telephone bill? Yeah, exactly. And that was mostly the problem. So the approach was super interesting. We have some code on the left-hand side. So the way these web pages, they use the wireless markup language, and WAP stands for Wireless Application Protocol. So the way it worked, you had a wireless markup language file, WML, and it had several what they called cards. And these cards were like considered as pages. And then you had buttons. You could navigate back and forth between the pages. And they also had WML script, which could like dynamically pull contents, but mostly you were rendering these WML pages. So if someone came and wanted like flight information or any other dynamic or interactive information, the server would like generate it, ASP, JSP, whatever, and then return the WML cards for it. And it was technically, it was very good, I would say. It was quite okay. It was pretty nice. I built some WAP pages myself back then. I found it fantastic. There were also like I think three or four very, very good emulators available. But the problem of the whole thing was it was just too expensive for the consumer. It was a nightmare. The technology was perfectly fine. But being charged like €5 to use it for like a minute, that got people shocked. Yeah, and we'll come back to it later because, I mean, if you touch your bottom right pocket, you realize that this is not the end of the mobile internet, right? So the thing came back. Yeah, then we have something that most people hate and others love, but I don't care. It's 2002, and that was the birth year of Microsoft.NET, and Microsoft also switched from their very popular Visual Basic onto Microsoft C Sharp that most people use today. And that was one of the biggest shifts, because Visual Basic was a cash cow for Microsoft, one of the most popular programming languages. And it lived for more than 10 years. It was the most profitable programming language. But they saw a slow move to languages like Java that were a little more designed like C++, so curly braces and all of that, more like easier to understand syntax. And that's why Microsoft came up and said, well, we also need Java, but obviously we don't have the licenses, so we come up with something that's called C#. So, and there were books about how to migrate to C#. The reason I have it included here is not because I love the language, but C# and the .NET framework for a period of time became extremely popular for a variety of things, for a vast variety of things. Mobile web development, mobile app development on Windows mobile devices, of course, and desktop applications. So that was really a beast that could do anything. In the Microsoft world, agreed, but it was something that could like dominate for its short-lived time. I would say like 5 to 6 years, it was able to really dominate a lot of things. Then a couple of years later, I mean, don't be too picky on the dates, but around somewhere early 2000s was the breakthrough when Linux finally came through and people didn't have to pay like license fees to run a web server and things like that, which were often the case with Microsoft and many other vendors. And one of the key approaches, and that's something that we see in software throughout, is that operating systems and software become very popular if they're developer-friendly, because then they start to build kinds of an ecosystem and people work on it. And like one developer can like install something on like hundreds of machines, right, just by using the component. So the problem in the early days was, if we look back at Visual Basic 3, the problem with Visual Basic 3 is for absolutely everything that you needed a component, creating a PDF file, scaling an image, the operating system didn't have a library for that. And Windows, for a very, very long time, had a very limited set of libraries. Even today, Windows has a very limited set of libraries of what you can do, especially when it comes to media, especially when it comes to different file formats. So if you wanted to create a PDF file or an Excel file in Windows, in most of the cases, the user had to have Microsoft Excel installed, otherwise it wouldn't work. So, and the great thing with Linux was, and still is, it has a library for absolutely everything, if not on board, available in any repository, right? That you can either package or even take the source and make it part of your application, depending on the license it comes with. So that's really the approach that made it very popular with developers, because you finally have access to tons of libraries that beforehand you would have to pay hundreds of dollars for. Then, of course, the repository approach is superior. It's been used ever since. iOS, macOS, Windows, all start to have, Android, all start to have central repositories. Yes, they call it App Store and Play Store, but still a central repository that's managed. So that's kind of an approach that's superior and has proven to be the dominant one. And Linux has ever since become the dominant operating system for absolutely everything. And people, I mean, it was funny, all of you are very with the Linux community for a very long time. There was always the discussion to run Linux on the desktop, which, I mean, the desktop is no longer plays a vital role in people's lives because on mobile devices. But Linux has taken over absolutely everything except the desktop, because no one cares about the desktop anymore. And probably Linux will one day be the most popular desktop operating system, because no one uses, I mean, the large majority of people out there don't use a desktop, because they have their mobile phone and tablets. And we're talking about real consumers. So that's why also some application structures, but we'll get to that later. Linux has the most target platforms. Yeah, so that makes it very feasible for anything. And I don't think I need to go into too much depth of this one. Then we have the mobile app breakthrough around 2010. iPhone was released in 2008. Android a year earlier, I think. And that made breakthrough. Also because the device manufacturers, Google and Apple as well, made the network operators to allow lower prices for network data charges, plus Wi-Fi arrived, and Wi-Fi wasn't really there when the Palm and the WAP era ended. So that's kind of two changes where the environment suddenly allowed these applications to fight their market. Still very complicated, a bit like if you know Palm OS and the way Palm development went, it's a silo, right? And for iOS, it's still a silo. For Android, yes, it's still a silo, because you have to go through that repository. Even if you have open source software to openly build iOS and Android apps, you still have to go through that repository, Play Store, App Store silo. And that's still a problem. Wasn't a problem with the Palm, because the Palm would, I mean, the Palm, if you wanted to install an application of the Palm, you could just send it through Infrared and it would install it automatically. Yeah? Don't talk about security on this one, yeah? Because you could just infrared it over and it would install it. We still have cross-platform tools. We always had them in the past as well, cross-platform tools to cover any operating system. And they're still very popular, talking about React Native, for example, a lot of other tools that evolved over the time. But it's still very much vendor lock-in on mobile development. But in 2010, that was the breakthrough, but you still had to use Xcode and Android Studio is called now. So, and then in somewhere around 2012, don't hammer me in on this one, is the death of all version control systems, because finally everybody's moving to Git. And that's kind of, I have the slide here, you might think, okay, what does this have to do like with history? It's very, very important, because if you build a software, anyone can have a Git moment, right? Where someone comes and says, well, but this is the Git now. So move Mercurial, Subversion, CVS, all the others, move them all behind. If you look up version control systems on Wikipedia, you can see a lot of abandoned defunct ones now. I mean, Git is very good, yeah? But it's like, why use anything else? I mean, if you have an argument of why you should any other version control system other than Git, I'm happy to hear it. But that's kind of 2012 was the Git moment where everybody migrated popular services like Bitbucket. They stopped their Mercurial services and migrated every customer over to Git. So that's kind of everybody's using Git now. And things like if you were back in the Visual Basic days, you had Subversion, QVCS, CMVC, Clearcase, tons of things, and one worse than the other. Yeah? So that's kind of 20 years of version control systems, and it's all gone. It's just Git. And that's kind of, if you build a software, anyone that builds a software can have this Git moment. Someone comes around the corner, and this is kind of de facto standard now. Then we have something, the next big thing, and that's software as a service. If we kind of try to reevaluate what I was talking on the previous slides, we had desktop applications, we moved to web applications, so we no longer had a client with a database shipped to the customer, but slowly and surely moved to the customers running on our infrastructure instead of we shipping the software. In simple cases, yeah, I'm not talking about like appliances or things that you put in automobiles, talking about the general home user and business applications. And that's kind of 2015. We're only like 7 years in the past now. And that's why most ISVs, independent software vendors, who are especially talking about the commercial world here, are moving their offerings from on-premise to browser and their own infrastructure, or mobile app and their own. So they're shipping thin clients, and the majority of their application runs on their infrastructure. Yeah? And that's also in the open source world where people realized, hey, I have a library that's GPL version 2, and anyone that wanted to ship that library, well, had to ask me for a different license, right? Because you can't ship GPL version 2 stuff alongside your commercial stuff. That's not possible. And that's when they came up with V3 and I think ALGPL something, where because the problem was if you run a software as a service and you have a ton of open source GPL V2 libraries in there, you have no obligations to anyone because you're not shipping them. You're running them yourself. And that's why what GPL V3 tried to fix, because they're, if you look at very popular ones, and I'm just going to give one example, FFmpeg, and the libAV team, yeah, very popular for video, encoding, transcoding, everything. Most of the streaming services wouldn't exist without this software, right? But the streaming service had no obligations to donate back or give source code back because they never shipped the package. They just ran it on their own service, and that's kind of where things are changing a lot because these three-tier web applications are now slowly being replaced with 12-factor apps. Look it up if you don't know what it is. And that's pretty much, I think, something we have on the next. That's infrastructure and code and serverless applications, where you no longer have your PHP application with your MySQL database or equivalent, but you're running decoupled services on your own infrastructure or mostly cloud infrastructure. If you think about things like video streaming services, not going to call out the name, but the most popular ones, you can look them up, their architecture is public. Video streaming services, online shopping systems, the whole e-commerce thing, but also client applications. If you look at WebAssembly. Who of you have heard about WebAssembly? Yeah, WebAssembly actually allows you to compile a lot of things, and there are people that compile entire operating systems in WebAssembly. WebAssembly actually means your browser can run almost anything that your desktop application can do, right? So, and that means the client side is very, very capable. The server side has no limitations if you're on any of the cloud providers, because you can eat up as much infrastructure as you want. And that means and you're way faster because you're not dealing with infrastructure anymore. You're doing infrastructure as code. Yeah? And that means development speed for these companies is way faster. Deployment, they don't need to deal with deployment because they have automated CI/CD pipes. And that means this is a huge advantage over people still running three-tier web applications. So if you still run your blocks or open source block software on your five servers and your shared file system and your database cluster, you have higher operating cost, you have longer time to market, and more development effort to put in compared to what the big internet giants do. I think that's the biggest change. So if we look at, again, we need to recap, if we look at how Visual Basic evolved and then into web applications and into more modern application development, this is what's going on right now. Like, because we've seen it from Visual Basic 3 to like web applications, like let's not say 96, say like the 2000, the real web application, the Google Maps types things. That's like 10 years, roughly 10 years. So and this whole like serverless thing started around like 2015, 2018. So that's coming to its prime now. So and we can always see this in technology prior. If in the late 80s you would have told someone, well, we're running our business with this operating system, now they would say, why do we even need an operating system? Let's do it on the machine directly and write our own application, because we're becoming dependent on this operating system. So technology and software is always like an onion, and it adds layers and layers and layers. So then when you move from like Visual Basic to the whole web development approach, you had your web server and the database, and that was another layer of onion, right, that added on top. So it's kind of these layers all stacking on top, and this is just another layer that is coming up, is infrastructure, right? I have some examples from the large cloud providers. There's open source software that you all know that you can run serverless with yourself. But that's kind of really what's changing now. And that's something as dramatic as all the changes that were previously. So it's pretty much like moving from the three-tier web app to the 12-factor app is pretty much like the desktop application to the web application. That's just how it works. And if you haven't done it, go give it a try. And then we have read the title. Yeah, I'm not serious with this one. JavaScript has been around since 97 or something. And it's made several appearances. Its first appearance on the Netscape communications server as a server-side language, so you didn't have to write CGI applications. You could do it in JavaScript on the Netscape communication server. If you get hold on Netscape communication server and you install, you try it, it's the worst experience you can have in programming, because it was very, very new. Netscape was engaged in its battle with Microsoft and other vendors. Then it came back with ASP. It came back as a server-side language, a couple of other implementations. And we also had it several times on client-side. Microsoft Windows always supported JavaScript for scripting, a couple of other operating systems did. So, and today it's one of the most popular ones besides Java itself, besides Python, and Visual Basic is gone. And I think that Visual Basic is gone thing is very, very interesting to see, because there wasn't just Microsoft Visual Basic, there were other basics before, right? But they all vanished, right? They're all gone. So the question is, the programming language that you're using today, be it JavaScript, be it Java, be it whatever it is it going to be a Visual Basic, right? So because if you look at, maybe you wrote some software last week, and you think about it, and think about it yourself, what will it look like in like 5 to 10 years? Will it be like some old abandoned Visual Basic application? And I think that's something, if people build software, yes, there's always a moment when things seem to change dramatically, but in essence, they never do. And most of the software that I have seen that died had a slow death, like super slow death. Yeah. So, and that's one thing. So your software doesn't die overnight. It slowly dies. The user base slightly reduces, and then it fades out. Think about video players for Microsoft Windows, for example. That was a huge market. Everybody knows Winamp, right? Winamp was the go-to media player until, like, Microsoft decided and Apple decided to roll in their own on their operating system, and then desktop wasn't important anymore. So, but that's kind of, if you look back on all these changes, it's very highly likely that these changes still, in one form or another, come back, right? So, and the programming language question is still there. We still have a lot of programming languages. But we also had a lot of version control systems, right? So, but the question is, Python, JavaScript, C++ has been around for almost forever, yeah? And I was asked once by a recruiter, this is a recruiter joke, you all know the recruiter jokes. He called me up and said, you're doing C++, who is still doing C++? Everybody's doing JavaScript. And I asked him, what do you think Node is written in? He said, I don't know, it is C++, so yeah. Question answered. But JavaScript is pretty much, the reason I have it here is very similar to C#. C# was like web applications, desktop applications, and mobile applications. JavaScript pretty much is the same at the moment. It has desktop applications through this Electron stuff, web applications through things like React Native, and of course, web applications with Node.js. So yeah, this is pretty much still a game to be decided. The outcome might be that we still have a lot of different programming languages, which I think will be, or it will probably be a Git moment, but I don't think it'll be a Git moment. Yeah? But if we look back, and this is my last slide, if you look back at all the history of software development, yeah, especially one thing that I get asked, I have my own a small software company founded a couple of 2 years ago, and I've been in software development for a very long time. And what I have often asked by young engineers is, like, they say, I want to run my own software business. What application should I build? Now, first and foremost, you would do something that you're super excited about. But if you look at something like ZVAB is a publisher of old books. They have all the old books from all the old book dealers on their site listed. There's a lot of software that existed 20 years ago that's gone forever. And it's not that people don't need that software, it's just the engineers retired, no one wanted to maintain it. Trust me, it's a lot of very old software where they just said it's too much hassle to migrate from Visual Basic 6 to Java or whatever they should have migrated at the end of the 90s. So there's a lot of abandoned software out there. There are software archives, archive.org. So if you need a great idea for a fantastic software, just look up the ones that no longer exist and that people still need, but they don't exist. I personally know someone that has written a software in the early 90s that's gone forever and has no replacement since. There's no replacements. The customers are still there. Some of them use them in emulations. And I also know of a large retail chain in Germany that still uses their ERP system in some sort of terminal emulator because they haven't had a replacement for it, because it has very special features. So number one, it's super exciting to do old software, so try to do it. Number two, if you love computers, like, check out the Computer Chronicles. It's all the histories in there, something that's not even in the books. Check out the old, I have a lot of old books. So the Palm OS programming I did, I have two of the only existing books on the topic. I mean, there are still editions, still books out there, but the two only editions. There's a Facebook group of vintage programming. My favorite vintage programming community is the COBOL community. It's super active. I think the average age is the late 60s now. But there's super, super, I once wrote an article, and it was also featured on IBM.com. It was very fun. A lot of COBOL people came to me and said, finally someone writing about our language. It's still alive. And if you want to get rich overnight, just do COBOL. That's the easiest way. Don't do YouTube, just do COBOL. This will also be this one. And yeah, that's it. Thank you very much for attending.
Yes, over there. There's a question. I'll bring you a microphone.
When you say do the stuff, do you really compile the software, or do you just install it in the emulator, or how do you recreate those programs?
Yeah, so you can compile it. I mean, that's the whole, you need to go through the struggle, right? So it's like if someone drives a 1960s Mercedes-Benz, yeah, he's going through the full thing. So you take a virtual machine, you install Windows 3.1, the old macOS ones, you can run on emulators on any operating system. Linux works perfectly with any outdated operating systems. There are archive.org, a lot of companies, including Microsoft and former Borland, they have released a lot of the IDEs just as public domain, or we don't care what you do with it, releases. So you can, archive.org has them. They have them with the appropriate licenses, so it's not illegal. And yes, you can do, I mean, where is it? Yeah, that's a real screw. I mean, that's when I wrote an application. So it's an old Windows and a virtual machine with a Visual Studio Code and the SDK. That's all you can download this stuff. And then go through the complete horror. If you can do it for a day, you'll probably love the modern way of doing software. Yeah, but it's very fun. And you will see that the whole kind of vintage computing community is very, very active. It's becoming a thing only in the last 4 to 5 years now. Mostly in America, so they have like vintage computing festivals and things like that. So yeah, but you can go through the full experience, go on eBay, buy an old computer and go through the full thing, and then you know what it is like.
Yes, another question.
Was you really started with graphic mode, Windows, no text mode?
Sorry?
You have no pictures with text mode.
MS-DOS?
Yes. So that's the question my father also asked. Where's Fortran in this one, and why don't you have any COBOL running up? Yeah, so. Yeah, sorry. There are two options. A, this presentation goes for 5 hours.
Yes.
Yeah. Or B, we do an entire conference, and that will come. There will be vintage computing conference because they're in the US already. And then yeah, we can do an hour long workshop and go back to the very basics. Yeah. So it's just for the sake of time, I picked some very simple ones. Yeah, but I did Borland C on DOS as well. It's fun. It was nice. I mean, even better than Visual Basic sometimes.
Has gone in a comparable direction. So one of my first coding experiences with a real program, which was a game, was at the age of about 10-ish or something. Mm-hmm. And it was on a Mac SE, and it was HyperTalk as a thing.
So HyperCard.
HyperTalk, yeah. Yes. And that was completely different from the experience that you are describing here in the early things, because it was already an hybrid thing. Pointing to things, and it's not just code and stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
It was quite fun.
Yeah, I didn't, I mean, that was, I had to shrink it because they said you can only do a 1 hour talk and you can't do 5 hours. So I said, okay, I'll throw everything out. HyperCard is very, very, very interesting because similarities to HyperCard existed afterwards. There was something called Toolbook on Windows in the 90s, which was a clone of HyperCard in some form or another, especially for CD multimedia distributions, etc. HyperCard and these HyperCard clones were very, very popular. They also had programming interfaces where you could do small code. And what most companies or projects struggled with is when their HyperCard thing became very popular, they realized, oh, I should have made this a real application. Because it's not really a real application. You come with a lot of runtime environment. But definitely something for a vintage computing conference.
Yeah, you said that the most software written for Windows 3 was written in Visual Basic. My question is, were there also some software written in C, and what was the percentage?
Yeah, quantity, we're talking, and not forget, we're talking quantity, right? We're not talking quality. So professional software on Windows, like the really popular, really good ones, they were mostly written in C++. Yeah, Visual Basic was very, Visual Basic always, because the runtime was very slow, it was mostly business applications where runtime wouldn't matter. So things like Photoshop that came to Windows very late was usually initially a Mac application. Things like, of course, Microsoft's internal applications, that was all C++. So that was all like written in C++.
Small, medium business applications, right?
Yes, yes, yes. We're talking about the, oh, I need to do this for that business. And the if you didn't use Visual Basic, you probably shipped a full Microsoft Access thing with your Visual Basic for application that many companies still run. Yes.
Well, thank you for the talk and for the trip down memory lane. In fact, I used to do Visual Basic as well at the time. And I recently had a discussion on it on Y Combinator Hacker News about it. And we kind of agreed that the Visual Basic UI or the IDE. I'm not a professional coder. I'm more the admin type, but that forced us layman coders to do object-oriented and event-driven programming in a way that later technologies didn't, and was really easy to make programs. And on the question that we had before, I had a friend, and he, if I couldn't complete a project or something, he would use Visual C++ to write a DLL. And then you could include it in Visual Basic as a OCX or VBX file, so the sky was still the limit.
Yeah, the big thing that came with Visual Basic 3 and 2 was the what you see is what you get forms editor. That was a huge, the forms editor was a huge thing that drove a lot of people, oh, I can drop some buttons in there, and then I can like write down the code from the book, and that's what 80% of the business applications. Exactly, that was 80% of the business applications looked like that, and Delphi then came and said, for those who don't like it, they can do the same horrors with me. So, and the DLL thing is very interesting because we saw the Linux shared libraries, we saw the DLL thing, libraries, ActiveX controls on Windows as well, and it's pretty much similar with the whole API thing that you have at the moment, right? If you want, need to use a service that can like recognize faces on 5,000 images, well, you most probably use an API for that, which is like the distributed type of component, right? So that's kind of similar from an architectural perspective, but that's kind of evolved as well, the whole library and component thing.
Me again, sorry. So another thing that you had in the early years was much more focus on, need to focus on your algorithms, like how long they run or something, so make them efficient, because you didn't have space, you didn't have time, it was all slow, instead of maintainability or something. That was a change that probably also happened later on.
Yeah, the quality, there's the quality and performance thing changed, and that came late. And there's one thing that's now coming that most of you probably don't think of, it's about environmental effect. Right. If you have an open source blog software, if you have a website and you blog about your favorite dream vacations or shoes or whatsoever, and you have 5,000 visitors a month, which is already a lot for a small blog. If you have 5,000 visitors a month and you think about how many do I have between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., probably zero, but your server's still running, right? And you're still consuming energy, you're still polluting. And every line of code that takes too long sucks up energy and pollutes our environment. So that's something that's coming to software development now. It's like environmental footprint, right? So what machines am I running on? Does the software really have to run, right? Do I have to have the three-tier web application operational 24/7, or can I use shared infrastructures such as in serverless environments where I only use the infrastructure if there's really a need, an event that requires my application to run? And I think that's coming now. So that's a huge one. And performance, finally, with the cloud providers, or if you use shared infrastructure, it comes with a price tag. And that makes performance much more relevant, because if you now optimize your application that previously ran 30 minutes to run 5 minutes, there's a cost associated with that that you can save. So it's easier to tell your non-programming boss that you saved some money, and he will probably ask, where is it?
There are no more questions. Thank you very much. Give him a warm round of applause. And another hint for all of the vintage computing fans, there's at least a vintage computing festival in Berlin here in Germany.
I've never been there, but probably will go there. So.
When is it?
I think October, November, right?
Yes, somewhere late in the year. I don't know the exact date right now.
Yes, can still go. I think that's cool. Maybe probably I'll go as well.
Will there be some attempts to make old software
open source? There were, but if you, I'm seeing the barbecues already opening, right? So I will be at the barbecue. So if you want to hit me up.